No one had a clue of what they were doing in on the pitch.
What about taking off the substitute?
Sorry, can you say it again? Sorry.
Okay, well, we'll assume that was lost in translation.
He said, the reason we're in or losing is because you're with your boyfriend, and said that I need to break up with my boyfriend because that's the reason Orient aren't winning.
Mr. Becchetti has a great charisma, and the players definitely feel his absence.
He's just a downward spiral the whole time. The whole time. Nothing positive whatsoever.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 10 of The Circus Upstairs.
I'm James Masters, a mildly concerned Leighton Orient supporter and journalist.
Oh, it's quite a roller coaster, your state of mind about Orient, isn't it?
My Orient emotions are just every day a different emotion map. Some days it's all sunshine, some days it's all just rain.
Thrilling, isn't it? I should say we're recording this in December 2023, at which time neither of us can remember the last time Orient won a game. Own goals is our top goal scorer this season.
Yeah, very underrated. Always look dangerous.
I am Matt Simpson, who might have forgotten to press record for the last half hour that me and James were chatting to each other through this episode. So this is the second time we've done this. All the good gags are gone. Stick with us if you want, but I can't promise this is going to be any good.
There were some really good gags. And
oh my God, we were on fire.
It was probably the best episode that we've not recorded.
I'm so sad for the listeners that I hadn't pressed record. Let's try again.
You have pressed record this time.
It is definitely recording. Why don't you tell us where we got up to by the end of episode 9?
Okay, so Orient went into the season with Andy Hessenthaler as manager, presumably because nobody else would take the job. And despite some decent signings, August, well, was underwhelming. After 5 games, the O's were in 10th place with 7 points from 5 games. The Orient fans had seen club favourite Dean Cox forced out of the club, and they were livid. Things were not going well.
I was livid. I was disgusted by that. Let's not get into that again, because we will just be absolutely fuming about it. Let's reflect on the fact that, incredibly, Orient won their first game of September, which was against Morecambe, and then drew their second game of September against Carlisle. However, the fact that we were still more or less mid-table was not good enough for Francesco Becchetti, and he tasked head of recruitment and handsomest man in football, Rob Gagliardi, who many of you will remember, started off as a translator in the club, became goalkeeping coach, now head of recruitment, maybe still goalkeeping coach, no one knew. He tasked him with going on a signing spree into obscure parts of Europe. I'm thinking he got on a backpack, he got an Interrail ticket, he took some trains to some deep, dark places to try and find some new players. Who did he sign, James?
Well, Matt, he signed Teddy Mezeguet, the French defender. Mezeguet arrived injured, not just injured, but with a medium-term injury, so he couldn't actually play for quite a while. So that was really quite helpful.
I feel bad that I've suggested that France was an obscure place in Europe now.
Yeah, I'm not sure about your geography. It's been a recurring theme throughout this podcast.
Carry on.
I will do. We also signed Ulrich Unomo. You must have heard of him, Matt, when we signed him.
Do you know what? I didn't.
He was the French under-20 forward. I think he was playing for Châteauroux. And my only interaction with Ulrich Unomo was that he sat a couple of seats away from me at Notts County during our 3-1 defeat, which was very exciting, obviously.
What was he doing? Like playing Wordle on his phone?
No, none of that. He was watching the game. He was looking mildly concerned, as we all were. And I think there were a few chants for him, actually. There were a few songs trying to get him integrated into the crowd. That's what I remember.
What were the songs?
I can't remember. I think it was like that.
No, Mo.
Yeah.
There's quite a lot of limit.
Yeah, so many limits. But he seemed to be entertained by that, and it was certainly more entertaining than football. On top of that, we had, well, Zan Bendicic, remember him? He started his career at AC Milan, Slovenian midfielder. I think he played one game on loan at Leeds United, so very exciting that he joined Orient. And then Jens Jantz was a defender who had a decent playing career in Holland. He was at Willem II, NAC Breda, and he played in Spain, he played in Georgia, he played in Italy, so he'd been around quite a bit, and he was a defender. So 4 players came in, and I'm sure you'd have heard of all of them.
Do you think those four players from quite well-established footballing countries in Europe were on manager Andy Hessenthaler's radar?
I'm going to go with no, Matt. I'm putting my neck on the line here.
Unhappily, the signing of those four players, despite their obvious pedigree, did not seem to help Orient because we lost our next two games against Yeovil and Notts County. And unfortunately, that spelt the end of Andy Hessenthaler's reign as manager. He had amassed 11 points from 9 games. We were 14th in the table. And we spoke to Andy about that and got his take on his sacking.
I suppose I could feel it was coming. And we had a run of games. We weren't picking up enough results. Not in a great position. But it was early, wasn't it? I mean, it wasn't long into the season. And again, as a manager, you want time. I know nowadays you don't get much time because you want owners want success straight away. But because there was so much disruption there, you needed a bit of time to build things and have a real bit of consistency to try and, if you're going to have spells where things aren't going to go your way results wise, that will happen. What you need is just that little bit of time to correct that. But then obviously you didn't get time to do that. So, which is disappointing. But like I say, deep down, probably knew it was going to happen. And again, it was a shame because, like Ian and Kev and myself, you know, managers there, I think if we'd been out to do our jobs properly, like I said, then it could have been different. When I actually went into the club, like I said, I didn't envisage what was going to happen. I've been in football a long time, and I've never known anything like it in my football life, really, to be honest. And it was tough. I didn't envisage all what had gone on, I've got to say.
I suppose when you look back at your time at Orient, you must have enjoyed some of it, though, no?
I loved it. You know, the club, like I said, it's a great club. But I enjoyed it. As much as it was a turmoil at times, I actually really enjoyed being there in a chapter in my footballing life. So I really did enjoy it.
That's what I love about you as a journalist, James. He spent ages telling us what a terrible time he had. And then you're just breezily like, you must have enjoyed it, though.
He was so reluctant to take the job, wasn't he? And yet he did it. He tried really, really hard. He just never, like everyone else, or how many times I have to say, he never stood a chance given what was going on above him.
I really like Hess. I think I would like to go for a drink with Hess. I think he'd have a pretty straight up lager, wouldn't he? He wouldn't have any sort of sway with new craft beer or anything like that, would he?
No, he was proper old school and I respected him.
Here. I should say to listeners to open the fourth wall slightly. This is the bit James and I got to before I realised that I wasn't recording. So you can expect it's going to get much better after this because it's the first time we've done it. Next, Andy Hessenthaler's assistant, Andy Edwards, who'd been at the club a long time, was previously manager of the youth team, took charge temporarily for our next game, which was a home game against Plymouth, which didn't really go that well. Captain Robbie Weir was sent off after 20 seconds. And then, can you believe it, new signing Jens Jantz was sent off after 14 minutes. So we were down to nine men after 14 minutes and inevitably lost the game. Only 2-0 though.
Dreadful evening. It was just so symptomatic of everything that was going on at the time. And if you could have used one game as an example of just how wrong things were, I'm sure that would be it.
The next game was against Barnet, a massive London derby.
Massive. Not like Dagenham. That's not a big derby. Barnet Orient is a big derby.
It was 0-0, James.
It was dreadful. It was one of the worst games of football I've ever witnessed, Matt. I remember coming home and just sitting there and thinking, why have I wasted my life watching that horrendous? Let's move on. Let's not even talk about it.
Happily, the next thing that happened was the announcement of a new manager for Leighton Orient. And I mean, I am quite choked up even being able to announce this because for Orient fans, this was quite a special moment. It was announced that the manager of Leighton Orient was going to be none other than Alberto Cavacin. James, I said Alberto Cavacin.
Yeah, I just want to say something here, Matt, because Alberto Cavacin, I didn't know who Alberto Cavacin was. I'm going to put that straight out there now. I would say about 3 hours before Orient appointed Alberto Camusen, I was on BBC Radio London talking about Orient's search for the next manager. And I was saying how important it was that Orient was who knew the English game, who knew how to recruit players in English football, who would be able to get us out of what I felt was going to be a very difficult situation, possibly a relegation battle. I think at the time, one of the favourites was Graham Westley. He'd been at Peterborough. I think he'd been at Lincoln Stevenage. So I did the interview with BBC London, and I think 5 minutes later, I checked my Twitter and we'd appointed Alberto Camusen.
You're going to have to now get up the Wikipedia page for Alberto Camusen and try and explain to listeners who he actually was. Assuming he has a Wikipedia, but has he got a Wikipedia page? Have Wikipedia standards dropped so low that they've let Alberto Camusen have a page? Okay, explain to us who he is.
So Alberto Camusen, he was more or less a journeyman manager. He was in the lower leagues in Italy in Serie B for most of that. He had a short spell in Serie A with Sampdoria in 2010-11. Which ultimately led to the club being relegated. And his Wikipedia page doesn't say much about what happened between 2011 and 2016, because he wasn't in work. He wasn't managing. So in 2011, he gets relegated with Sampdoria, disappears. And in 2016, that's 5 years later, he turns up at Leyton Orient in League Two in England.
So I wanted to find a bit more about this, particularly about his time at Sampdoria. So I managed to find a lovely guy by the name of David Gillo, who runs the Sampdoria Fan Club of England. And I asked him about Alberto Camusen's spell at Sampdoria.
You know, he's one of that manager. We have a lot of this kind of manager in Italy that they live between Serie A and Serie B. Is like, you know, a good manager for the Serie B is a manager in Serie A that, you know, there are this kind of manager that when you are in trouble, you take them and you hope that they can save the season. But, you know, the fact it was the surprise in 2011 was different, because the team was a great team. There was Cassano, there was Pazzini, there was a lot of players. So that season was awful. I mean, it's still an X-file in Sampdoria history. And the fact that Camusen arrived was like the top of the mystery. Because, I don't know, there was the gap to save the team. And he failed everything. Like he had a bad, very bad behavior with a supporter. He was very arrogant. The first things that he said when he arrived in Italian, he say, "Io sono un fenomeno." That it means I'm a phenomenal. You know, we call phenomeno Ronaldo. Ronaldo, the Brazilian player. He is a phenomenon. And Camusen arrive and say, "I am a phenomenon. I will save you." So from that, and he was really, really arrogant in all the interviews. He didn't accept any critics. Like he acted like he was a phenomenon, but he wasn't. So,
what did fans think of his tactics and his team selection?
I think that so the result was like that he had no clue. No one had clue of what they were doing on the pitch. So he was like a very ugly football, let's say. You know, he was after two games, you could already say, okay, we will go in Serie B. There is nothing to do, nothing to save. Was awful. Like, I don't know why we had this kind of manager.
So exactly the type of pedigree that you would want to bring to a struggling League Two club in England, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, not only did I feel completely stupid having just gone on the radio and said all that about bringing a manager who knew what they were doing, but then I didn't even know what to think, Matt, if I'm honest. And the people, you know, fans were just flummoxed by the decision. things were bad, but this just felt like it was going to get even worse. And there was, at some point, you're hoping that the grown-ups are going to take charge of the situation. Except the grown-ups were just stood at the bar and the kids were going mad. And I don't know what was going to happen next. It was, I think even if you knew nothing about football, you knew the next few weeks were not going to go well.
My take on it is this, like, for me, this felt like the point where Bechetti started to deliberately sink the club and spite the fans. And I genuinely mean that. There can be no other reason why he appointed Alberto Cavicin. I feel like he felt that he, in some way, tried to listen to fans by appointing Hendon and a sort of fully English backroom team. He felt that didn't work. He appointed Kevin Nolan. He felt that didn't work. He appointed Hessen Taylor. He felt that didn't work. He just thought, fuck it. I don't care anymore. I'm just going to hire an obscure Italian manager. And that will really, really annoy the fans.
Yeah, but I think Cavicin was manager number 8 of the regime. At what point do you start to think, oh, hang on, maybe it's not the managers and the players that are the problem here? Maybe it's me? Yeah, that's where he should have been at that point. And obviously that never happened because he had surrounded himself with people who were not going to critique him. Just unbelievable, really.
We spoke to George Sessions, who was one of the local journalists covering Orient, about the Cavicin appointment.
And they said this guy's name, and I was like, whoa, no idea. I remember thinking, oh, you know, optimistically before I Google searched him and looked at Wikipedia, he might be sort of like a young, ambitious Italian manager. And then I found that he was like this 60-year-old guy that hadn't managed for absolutely ages and had just been like a journeyman manager in Italy.
And here's Leighton Orient kitman Ada Martin, who'd seen quite a lot of managers come and go at this point, with his take on the appointment of Alberto Cavicin.
Cavicin was different. Felt like your granddad was taken over because he was quite old, wasn't he? But it was weird. The Italians were quite excited about him coming in. So I think he was quite a big personality in Italy, like doing their equivalent of Match of the Day as a pundit. But we just saw probably another failure, really. No, he's doomed to failure straight away.
In his first interview as Orient manager, Cavicin said that he'd spent a lot of time studying the team, a lot of time studying the league. But surprisingly, that didn't seem to help that much because we lost the first two games under his reign at home to Luton and then against Portsmouth. Here's George again on what happened there.
It was really nice. He was a really polite guy, but again, similar with Livrani, he couldn't speak the language. And he had a translator. And again, the translator wasn't the greatest. He was like a young lad. And I think, you know, when you've appointed this random Italian manager who's, you know, showed no, it didn't make any sense. So it was just another kind of, like, why is he appointed this guy? What is going on, really? That was the main thought process. And I mean, Alberto was a nice guy, but he just, on the foot pitch, he didn't really have a clue. We sort of asked him, what have Orient got to do to kind of get out of the relegation zone or to get out of this relegation battle? And he started talking about like gladiators and going in with your swords and like wearing your helmet. And we were just sitting there like, what the hell is talking about swords and helmet? It was just like, this is so strange.
Incredibly, and maybe as a consequence of the Orient players taking to the pitch as gladiators wearing their helmets, they actually won the next game 3-1 away at Hartlepool. That, for me, is one of the great mysteries of the universe. And I'm not sure we can really analyse that in any way, but they did win that game. Next, normal service was resumed with a 2-0 home defeat to Crewe. It's probably worth us listening in to the post-match interview that Cavicin did with Dave Victor after that Crewe defeat, because I think it gives a little insight into what was going on in his brain.
Well, thanks for joining us. What did you make of that performance?
Cosa pensi della prestazione?
Beh, è stata, dobbiamo prenderla globalmente ed è una prestazione negativa.
Well, we have to look at this globally, and certainly it wasn't a very good performance.
Atangana was probably the standout performer. Why did you take him off?
Atangana sembrava quello che stesse giocando meglio, perché l'ha tolto?
Cambiare lui o cambiare Collins o cambiare Weir era... Dovevo solo valutare quello che era forse un po' più stanco negli ultimi 3-4-5 minuti, che mi sembrava un po' così.
So they were all playing more or less the same. So I could have taken out Weir, Atangana or Collins, but at the end I chose to take out Atangana for this reason.
You thought about taking off the substitute?
You said Collins.
You think about taking
off? No, era per Collins, no? Okay, sì, sì. Ho chiesto, quindi ho pensato di far togliere anche Collins, quello che è appena entrato.
No, non avevo pensato.
No, non ho capito. Non ho capito. Sorry, can you say it again?
Sorry.
Okay, we'll assume that was lost in translation.
Do you think Cavsin might not have actually known which player was which?
I mean, there's a very good chance, Matt. There's a very good chance. But I think also that interview with Dave, who is so polite, so patient, also gives you an insight into just how difficult it was with the language barrier.
Can you imagine the team talks?
Well, I imagine he came in with Wolf from Gladiators and just let Wolf do it, no?
Next, we had an FA Cup game against Sheffield United, which, surprisingly, we only lost 6-0.
Yeah, I think we take that. Happy with the nil. Probably lucky to get nil, but we'll take it.
Yeah, single figures, didn't concede more than 6. That was good.
And we kept 11 players on the pitch.
Next, incredibly, we beat Colchester 3-0. Another very inexplicable result. Our next home game was against Blackpool. And this is probably a good time to introduce what was going on in the background a bit, particularly around Loft. So Loft is the Leighton Orient Fans Trust, a supporters group who come together to try and act in the best interests of the club. And they've started to think about how they could protest or how they could try and unite fans around protesting against Bechetti himself. So we spoke to Tom Davis, who is one of the committee of Loft and its media officer, around what was happening.
Obviously, then yeah, the next kind of unheard of manager, Cavsin, who came in, decent guy, but completely inappropriate for the situation. And that kind of accelerated and says, okay, we need to kind of mobilise a little bit. And as it happened, our AGM, that was early November 2016, and that became a quite a focal point, and we kind of plugged that quite a lot. And also because we saw that we were playing Blackpool a couple of weeks after that, and they were right in the middle of their campaign against the Oystons, who were similarly ruining their club. So we got in touch with their Sports Trust and fan activist groups up there and said, what about a bit of joint action for that game? And that kind of really took off when we had this AGM at the Birkbeck in Leytonstone, which normally our AGMs are kind of fairly sedate affairs, you know, like 50 or 60 people and perhaps an ex-player and, you know, just some amiable banter. This time it was people queuing down the stairs of the upstairs room, and as a complete urgency, to what people were talking about, lots of different ideas batting about. And, that's when we started to talk about, you know, different scenarios. You know, perhaps do we need to, kicking around all sorts of ideas at that point, do we need to increase our shareholding, try and force something at board level? Do we just, what type of protest do we do? Do we actually call for Bechetti to go? Because I think at that point we decided we weren't going to directly say Bechetti out. We were going to say change your ways or sell. That was the kind of, at that point, at that November meeting, that was the kind of a slogan, if you like, that came out of it.
So can I ask what the mood was like at that AGM?
It was quite encouraging in a way, just to see the level of kind of passion and ideas on view. That's what I kind of, you know, these crises do bring out the best in people. And you saw people really kind of almost like thinking on their feet, coming up with different suggestions, some of which worked, some of which wouldn't. An occasional bit of, you know, a bit of friction as people, you know, as passions rose. But it's kind of, you know, it's what you want, really.
Why did you, given everything that had happened and what you're aware of, hold back from calling for Bechetti himself to go at that point?
I think we're trying to kind of keep everyone united. And if you go, you know, there's probably a sense of like, if we went in too hard, if we'd gone in too hard maybe a year earlier, you might still have had people saying, well, we're six in the league and we might have a chance of this. And so we almost, for right or wrong, we kind of thought, well, let's hold back a little bit and wait till there is a situation where people are united. So keep that unity going. And I guess also there's that whole kind of get behind the team. You don't want to necessarily completely abandon the team thing. Well, even though the players obviously were even more, all the standings you got, the players are even more angry and unhappy with the way the club was being run than probably we were. Because it was their day-to-day life. And same for the rest of the club staff who were treated dreadfully. Yeah.
So the protest was organised for that game. A big group of fans marched to the ground. Everyone stood up in the 18th and 81st minutes. Why is that, James?
Is it to do with the fact that Orient found in 1881?
Well done. Yeah, I was sort of impressed with the sort of the unity and the sense of action around that.
Yeah, I felt similar, that just felt so helpless for so long. And I think once we started mobilising, I'm not sure I was as confident that we would have much effect at that stage. I wasn't confident we'd have much effect. I think my confidence grew as things got worse and our voices grew louder. You know, it's quite inspiring to see so many people mobilising and having different views and ideas. And you could really see the passion that people had for our club coming through. And I do think Loft deserve a tremendous amount of credit for what happened.
For sure. Here's what Tom's take of the actual day was.
It's probably, I don't know, maybe a couple of hundred, 300. And we sort of had a sort of good humoured, you know, friendly march down that Leighton High Road from there. And then we were giving out these stand up for the Orient little sheets for everyone to stand up, everyone to hold up after 18 minutes, which actually created a good visual effect, and it kind of, you know, that worked. And and it was, you know, Blackpool fans joined in, they supported us, we applauded each other, all that kind of stuff. And we repeated that when we played Blackpool at the end of the season up there. We had a good march on the promenade at Blackpool, which was nice. So yeah, so that kind of, there was you would get a few people who were not sure about, you know, were against the idea of protesting. So there's a little bit of noises off here and there, but overall it was a positive occasion.
Did you put a list of demands to the club, or sort of articulate what the change that you wanted was?
Well, we let them know what we were going to do, and we said this is what we'd like more consultation, we'd like a transparency about money, because we still didn't know much about the finances of the club at that point. And what, you know, obviously, you know, money being thrown around, then not thrown around, then, you know, all these comings and goings and sackings, and, you know, just some, you know, come and meet us was kind of, you know, one of the core demands. And we put them there just to say, look, we're prepared to be reasonable. We are not, you know, we're not just coming here to storm the barricades. And, you know, there's still a way out of that if you want to talk to us. And his response obviously was to throw his toys out the pram and never go to a game again, which is good news for managers' backsides. But said a lot about sort of owner he was.
So as Tom says, it was at this point that Bechetti stopped coming to games. This very mild, polite protest was the straw that broke the massive narcissist's back. Bechetti is clearly so thin-skinned that you can actually see through to his internal organs and the Valpolicella coursing through his veins.
Yeah, and he was so desperate, wasn't he, to be loved? He was so desperate for the fans just to think he was like this incredible person who came in, he saved the club, he was going to take us to great heights, he was going to make us into a Premier League team. I don't know if anyone really believed that, but that's what he was telling us. And he couldn't handle any real criticism. He just couldn't handle it. And I would say Orient fans, on the whole, quite mildly mannered. You know, like Tom said, they didn't want to go all out. They weren't calling for him to go. It was just, you know, you need to change. You need to do something, because if you carry on along this path, then things are going to get really bad. And he obviously didn't like it. And he thought, you know what? I've had enough. They can moan. I'm not going to stay here to listen to it. I'm off. And it appeared at that point he checked out.
Here's what Michael Clark, one of the youth team players that had come through to the senior squad that season, thought about that.
As an owner, he should almost be engaging with players and staff. Well, he should be. That's his job, right? but he wasn't. He was looked at as almost like he should have been like a godlike figure.
And here's Kitman Ader Martin.
He just had the ump because the fans were so against him and he couldn't work out. He's put all this money into their football club and they hate him. His head couldn't get round about how much what I've done for them and they don't like me. And it was all to do with high-fiving. You know, he used to go around high-fiving fans and all that. It was just a very, very strange person. Very narcissistic person, you know. It was weird. Really, really weird.
So we lost that game 2-1. One thing I remember from being at that game was that towards the end of the game, a fan coming down from up behind me and he'd used Google Translate to translate "you're getting sacked in the morning" into Italian, which, as you'll well know, James, is "ti licenzieranno domattina," which I thought was hilarious. Shouted it repeatedly to Cavazzin.
I see you've got the same Italian tutor as I have.
Also using Google Translate. So yes, we lost that game. We also lost the game after that, a 1-0 defeat to Exeter City at home. And we spoke to another of the local journalists covering Orient that season, Shona Duthi, about her experiences of reporting on Orient during the Cavazzin era.
Alberto, well, that was an experience. The funniest bit time was when it was the game just before he got sacked, we'd lost. He said, "The reason Orient are losing is because you're with your boyfriend," spoke to me and said that I need to break up with my boyfriend because that's the reason Orient aren't winning. And that if I break up with him, then Orient will start winning and his job will be easier. And we have to start playing that we have a knife in our teeth. And, you know, it was just bizarre. He was such an interesting character.
What?
Yes, that's what he said.
That is insane. That is absolutely insane.
Was there any evidence, but were you having difficulties with your boyfriend? Did you have any influence on the team?
I don't think so. No, not that I'm aware of. So that was quite, I found it quite amusing. I mean, it's not really amusing. It's kind of insane. But if you don't laugh about these things, then you will go insane yourself. So I was just kind of like, okay. And I think he started going around like reporters and saying to everybody like what they needed to do to make sure that Orient was going to like, you know, come out of this rut and then we're going to start winning. But basically it was something to do with all the reporters and not about him as a manager.
What's your take on that? Was he mad?
I just think he was out of his depth. I just don't think he had a clue what he was doing. He'd never managed in England before, I don't think. I didn't look like at any point he was going to learn English. Yeah, I just think he was completely out of his depth.
What are your boyfriends say, Shona?
Well, we're not together anymore.
Oh, there's a bit of a sucker punch at the end of that.
I still remember when we interviewed Shona and I just watched that entire clip. Or listen to that entire clip with my hand over my face because it just makes my skin crawl. What the hell? I mean, take some responsibility. You're the manager. Stop blaming everyone else for your errors.
Alberto Cavazzin was sacked after that Exeter defeat, having led Orient to 5 defeats in 7, inexplicably winning 2 games. So it was confirmed that manager number 9 of Bocchetti's reign was to be Andy Edwards, who'd previously stepped in as caretaker. What do you know about Andy?
Andy Edwards knows the club. He's been there for years. He did a really good job with the youth setup, been assistant manager before, very highly regarded as a coach. He was basically the only person left unless Ader fancied a crack himself, the kit man. So it was the only way he was going to go.
He lost his first game 3-1 to Doncaster Rovers, but then we had a pretty reasonable December under Edwards. So we won 2, drew 1, lost 1, which meant that by the end of the year, we'd moved up to 20th place. So just about outside the relegation zone with 25 points from 23 games. And here's Shona again on Andy Edwards.
I really liked Andy. And I thought he was kind of like bringing that balance back that Orient needed. Things were slightly turning around with him there because he'd been at the club for a long time. The players got on with him really well. He was Andy Hessenthaler's number 2. So I think it was working, and sadly it ended a bit too quick, I think.
So we went into the new year and things started to go even crazier. So the first thing that happened was 4 senior players, so Alex Cheesack, the goalkeeper, Callum Kennedy, Tom Parks, Jordan Bowery, were all transfer listed. And Andy Edwards came out and said that decision was taken above his head. Jay Simpson, who'd been with the club since the start of Bucchetti's reign, left to join Philadelphia Union in the States. Alan Dunn, another senior player, left for Bromley. Ollie Palmer, now starring in Disney Plus's Road to Wrexham, went to Luton. Terrible move. Where are they now? But then, probably one of the craziest things that happened in the whole of Bucchetti's reign, on the 20th of January, a statement was released on the club website, written by hapless CEO Alessandro Angeleri. I read it and I actually initially generally thought it was satire. And I was quite annoyed because I thought that is much funnier than my blog. I wish I'd written that satire. And then it was real, it was a real statement. And I think it's quite important that we hear that statement in full. We couldn't get Alessandro himself on the show. Sadly, I'm hearing reports that he's currently watching The Usual Suspects for the 498th time because he still can't figure out who Kaiser Sose is. So instead, we enlisted the help of Italian Orient fan Stefano Albano to voice the statement. So a big thanks to Stefano. Here's what Alessandro Angeleri said.
The actions of the club over the past 2.5 years have always been in good faith, and that can never be doubted.
James, the actions of the club over the past 2.5 years have always been in good faith, and that can never be doubted.
I mean, how could you possibly doubt it? The endless carousel of managers, the expenditure of money in the wrong places, the incredible failure at every opportunity.
Can never doubt it. I've got an analogy for you. So this is like me deciding to build a roller coaster without any previous experience of creating theme park rides. And then when all the passengers crash to their death on the very first ride, me saying, I had every good intention of the roller coaster working correctly, and that can never be doubted.
Now they teach you that in business now, that you have to assume good faith in the workplace. Someone makes a mistake, don't worry, you just assume good faith. And I think we should be generous to Alessandro.
Good faith is not enough, is it, if you don't know what you're doing? Let's carry on.
A squad without future was inherited and has been completely renewed with it today, including a number of talents aged between 17 and 24.
So a squad without future was inherited.
Yeah, absolutely. I absolutely agree with Alessandro there. The squad that reached the League One playoff final, playing some of the best football Orient fans have seen for 30 years and made us dream, you know, far more than we had done for decades. Was definitely a squad without a future. I'm being very sarcastic. What a load of bollocks. And when I say bollocks on the podcast?
I'm not sure you needed to say that you're being sarcastic there. Let's carry on listening.
Mr. Bucchetti didn't like the fan protest because at the beginning of the season, everyone, supporters included, pressed the club for the summer transfer business.
So Mr. Bucchetti did not like the fan protests because everyone at the beginning of the season had praised the club for their summer transfer business. Fair?
He didn't like the protests. He's not supposed to like the protests. That's the whole point of the protest. You're not supposed to like the protests because they're protesting against your ownership of the club and everything that you've done wrong. Of course, the fans were fuming at Mr. Bucchetti. The fact he didn't like it. Well, I'm very sorry for the gross inconvenience. We were feeling mildly inconvenienced by the fact that our club was about to go out of existence.
We were mildly inconvenienced by the fact he'd relegated us in his first season.
It's funny, so much time has passed, Matt, and yet whenever we talk about that, I still get quite angry.
I can see that.
Mm.
For the record, James is looking very angry, everyone. You would not want to be on the business end of that, is what I would say to listeners.
Absolutely. You'd be mildly inconvenienced.
So, Mr. Bucchetti did not like the fan protest. Let's listen to what Alessandro said about that.
Thereafter, Mr. Bucchetti doesn't play on Saturdays.
Thereafter, Mr. Bucchetti doesn't play on Saturday.
I think what he's trying to say is that Mr. Bucchetti does not come to the stadium on Saturday.
I think we can assume that via Google Translate that Alessandro did mean he doesn't attend anymore on Saturdays, but we can't completely discount the possibility that Bucchetti was thinking about playing himself in the team. Okay, Alessandro continues.
I think that within common sense, Mr. Bucchetti will continue to fund the club. True, appropriate offers for the club will be considered.
So just to be clear there, that Alessandro's saying that within common sense, Mr. Bucchetti will continue to fund the club, though appropriate offers for the club will be considered. So this was the first time it was announced that Piketty was even considering that he might want to sell the club, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I think everyone was very excited by this, although cautious, because we'd learned that not everything that was coming out of the club was entirely reliable.
Let's carry on listening.
One offer has been received, but it was not acceptable for a number of reasons.
That was Matt and I getting a bid of 10 sausage rolls in the Mars bar, so I'm not surprised that was turned down.
Yeah, I was upset that he didn't accept.
In regards to player departures, since last February, Jay Simpson had scored 6 goals. And from the last summer, he had been trying to leave the club. Andy Edwards rightly decided to leave him out of the squad because of his lack of commitment to Leyton Orient. Jordan Bower's contribution during the first half of the season was imperceptible, so his departure can be considered neutral.
Okay, so just to be clear here, Alessandro is now slagging off the Orient squad. So he slags off Jay Simpson, who scored a hatful of goals for us throughout his whole time here for showing a lack of commitment. And then very interestingly, he says that Jordan Bowery's contribution during the first half of the season was imperceptible. Was that your impression of Jordan Bowery, James?
Irrespective of what I thought about Jordan Bowery, the fact that imperceptible was the word used to describe him, I think it's one of the finest moments in the vocabulary of football. I've never, ever heard a footballer described as imperceptible, and I feel like it should go down in history, really.
I feel like I did perceive Jordan Bowery in human form during matches.
Yeah, he was definitely there.
I don't think he was imperceptible, but I have thought of some other things that are imperceptible. Alessandro Angileri's IQ. Impossible to perceive that. Where exactly Francesco Bacchetti got his money? Also imperceptible. Alberto Cavazzin's managerial skills. Impossible to perceive.
See, this is where you come into your own on this wordplay. You should write a blog or something.
I've got loads more, but I think let's listen to Alessandro continue his statement.
Andy can count on prospects who has helped nurture like Sam Sargent, Sandro Semedo, Miles Judd, Sam Dalby and Tristan Abrahams, who has scored 20 goals for the youth team this season.
So he's basically saying that Edwards can count on prospects from the youth team. I feel like he's slightly missing the concept that scoring goals at youth team level doesn't necessarily translate to playing first team football. So that would be like saying, well, there's a kid in the under 12 team that scored 20 goals, play him. There's a fat plumber who plays in goal for a local pub side. He's got 10 clean sheets this season, give him a shout. Doesn't make any sense, does it?
No. How I would interpret this is, Andy, sorry, mate, we're not going to give you any money or any funds. You've got a bunch of kids. Good luck.
Definitely. Let's keep listening.
As well as great young talent like Paul McCallum and Gavin Massey, who are players with fantastic qualities and have a massive desire that was lacking from players in the past like Darius Henderson, Joby McEnough and Jordan Bowery.
I love the fact he gets in a second dig at Jordan Bowery.
I just can't believe how unprofessional. I mean, this is the final season. Maybe I shouldn't be shocked anymore. But the fact you're digging out players in the club's statement is quite outrageous.
We now come to my favourite part of the statement.
I think that my absence due to ill health could have some negative effect.
So just in case your ears or anyone's ears are not quite comprehending that, what Alessandro said was that he thinks that his absence due to ill health could have had some negative effect. Can you think of any negative effect that Alessandro's absence from the club might have had? You can't, can you?
I'm thinking hard here. We don't want to do him a disservice. That's not fair.
You're an intelligent man with a deep knowledge of football and Orient. You can't think of any, can you?
No.
Let's carry on.
But I believe, even further, that the absence of Mr. Bacchetti during the last 3 months has had a more negative impact on the squad. His personal business did not allow him to be close to the team when he would usually come to the training ground every Friday and to the games on a Saturday. Mr. Bacchetti has a great charisma and the players definitely feel his absence.
Alessandro's gone big there, hasn't he?
Yeah, absolutely huge. He's gone in there and he said, basically, it's all their fault. Becchetti can't make it. You can't do it without him. If he was there, you'd be okay because my boss is brilliant.
I mean, it's quite a suck up to his boss through the medium of a public statement, isn't it? But the idea that Mr. Becchetti has great charisma is something I really struggle to understand.
I mean, I take exception to that, Matt, because I think any man who runs onto a football pitch in front of thousands of people and kicks the assistant manager up the arse definitely has something about them.
It's not the traditional definition of charisma, James.
Sometimes people just need a kick up the arse, literally.
Charismatically. Okay, this is the end of the statement.
We are fully confident that we will remain in the Football League come to the end of the season. But if it was to unfortunately happen, we will keep our current policy in place of promoting and showing faith in young players.
I love that. It's basically, we definitely won't get relegated by playing the youth team. But if we did get relegated, we'll just carry on doing that anyway.
I love how he said we're fully confident we will not go out of the Football League.
We talked a bit about his sort of business strategy, didn't we? That's a particularly good one. We're going to do something. It will probably work, but if it doesn't, we'll just carry on doing it anyway.
What could go wrong? What could go wrong, Matt?
We're going to find out, aren't we? Back on the pitch, Orient lost all four games in January, which meant that they dropped to 23rd position. That's back in the relegation zone, with 25 points from 27 games. Morale was obviously at absolute rock bottom. Here's kitman Ada Martin on what was going on.
By then, most of the players were cheesed off with it all. You got these players that were brought in on a, not on a promise, but hopefully for a good season, get this team back into League One. I could see by January time, we're going down. We're doomed. We're going down. Don't matter who they would have brought in as manager. We were relegated because you can just see it. I don't know how, but being around the dressing room for so long, you can read it quite well. And by then it was, people were just fed up with it, really. Really fed up with it. You walk in there and it'll be really down. You could tell someone that stayed for lunch, some would. There wouldn't be many people talking in the main canteen area there. People just don't hang around. It was in and out. I found it difficult working in those circumstances. All I was doing was washing the kit. For them, it was really, really hard. It's just a downward spiral the whole time. Nothing positive whatsoever.
And we also asked Ada how all of this was affecting his state of mind.
It made me quite a nervous person, so I didn't know what was going to happen day to day. So you become quite anxious every day you go to the training ground. What's going to happen? Managers wise, because you couldn't speak to them, what were they thinking? I became a more of an anxious person, and I'm still seeing that today, because at the time you've just got no idea, so you can't read nothing, you can't preempt nothing, so every day you're just anxiety the whole time, and that's not a great lifestyle.
To make matters worse, on the 29th of January, Andy Edwards resigned. We're going to hear Andy's resignation statement, not voiced by Andy himself. We couldn't get Andy, but instead, perhaps even better, by celebrity Orient TV presenter Oliver Buck. Many of you will know Oliver from presenting Orient Live. He actually told me he spent hours and hours in preparation for reading this statement out by listening to Andy Edwards speaking over and over again, which is a ridiculous amount of preparation given the quality of the rest of this podcast. But fair play to him, he's method acting. So here's Oliver reading out Andy's statement, and I think we can all agree doing a pretty solid impression of him.
Obviously, I would have liked it to last longer, but a number of circumstances made it very difficult for me. I have an emotional attachment to Leighton Orient, and I have been there a long time, but unfortunately, it was not the club that I joined, and I think every manager found that since Russell Slade left. It's really difficult and it's very hard to do when you're maybe not given the support or are faced with broken promises. You want to be able to put your imprint on it and bring in players, and that was not allowed. So it was a very difficult environment for anyone. If you are going to be in football management, you have to have the support of your board.
That's pretty brutal.
Yeah, and Andy's not the kind of guy who would go out and say these things unless he really meant them. You know, Orient had a big place in his heart. He spent a lot of time there. He had done a fantastic job bringing through a lot of the young players there. And as I said earlier, he was very well regarded. So it wasn't a huge surprise to me when he went on to his next job with the FA. He was working as the national specialist coach with the England development teams. I think that was pretty much the direction everyone thought he would go with.
Here's our friend Shona Duthys on Andy Edwards' resignation.
I didn't really see it coming. Like, I kind of did in a sense, because it was such a hard time to be a manager at Leyton Orient. Like, I would not want that job. If somebody was like, do you want to manage this club? I'd probably be like, I'll give that a wide berth. Or I might be drinking a vodka every day. Bottle of vodka, probably. I don't really blame him. But at the same time, I did think he probably was the man that was kind of trying to steady it. But then if you're having this uncertainty with the board and what's going on, because they're not very communicative at all, then I don't really know how he could see his job going further. I think maybe that's what he thought.
That brings us to the end of the episode, James.
I think that's one of the, in a weird way, Matt, actually one of the most enjoyable episodes, because it was just so mad. Absolute madcap stuff.
Three managers in a single episode. That's a record.
We're doing well, aren't we? We are getting through those managers.
Yeah, we're burning through them. The pace doesn't let up as we get into the next episode. That's for sure.
I could have spent an entire episode just discussing Angeleri's statement.
It needs to be framed and put in a museum somewhere. For the moment, thank you to everyone for listening. We hope you join us for the next episode where things go from worse to even worse. It's really, really bad. Keep listening.
I think this is one of the few podcasts I've ever heard anyone say, it was really, really bad. Keep listening. I like that, though. I think that's good.
Thanks, James. I enjoyed it.
Thanks for pressing record this time.
You're welcome.
Arrivederci.
No wave?
No, I didn't wave. There's no one to wave to, man. No one's looking.
Stop doing the wave. I was waiting for it. It's a shame.